Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 8:16 in that specific standard time. And, well, today's Thursday, Christmas Eve, and a recording for the big picture long-term audio. Last night, David and I had chatted and we had decided that we would take a holiday today, but I was up early to take a look at my positions. I haven't had this many positions open in quite some time, and I thought, well, if I'm up and watching the screens, I really should put out some copy. So here I am. And realistically, I think I'll probably be at my desk for at least part of Monday as well. And let me take this opportunity to wish a happy Christmas and all seasonal greetings to anyone who might be listening to the audio, wherever you might be, because we have a very diverse and globally positioned subscriber base. And you know, this is an interesting week in that you know, stock markets have been generally firm, and deep oversold conditions in the commodity sector, well, they came a little bit closer to being unwound. This is the first week in which a number of deeply oversold markets had finished at the upper side of the week's range. A number of the miners fit into that category. The worst performers on the S&P 500, practically without exception, of the approximately 15 shares that are down over 50% this year, there's, I think, 15 of them, and 11 of them are in the energy sector. And there aren't that many miners outside of the precious metal miners listed in the US. But if you go across the pond and look at the FTSE mining sector, then it's also experienced an accelerated decline. And this was the first week in really quite some time. I think it's since October that BHP Billiton has strung together consecutive days in the upside. When you look at the industrial mining sector, it's a similar story. And then look at the precious metals, where silver is still trading around $14. It's a little bit firmer in trading today. Platinum has still got a fairly deep overextension relative to the MA. So does palladium. I'm talking my book a little bit here, because so does gold. And my positions are all in the precious metals and in energy, and I've got a sort of a duff trade going on in oats at present, and I'm hoping that El Nino is going to do me a favor, but we'll see what happens there. When we take a little bit of a step back and we look, then putting what's happening in context, then this year hasn't been particularly great for stock markets. The Dow Jones is down about 1.5%. The S&P 500 is up just over 0.1%, and the Nasdaq has been really very steady. That's despite the fact that Apple has been underperforming, and that represents about 12% of the index. Breath hasn't been particularly good either. That the relative performance of the Nasdaq has been predicated on the incredibly impressive outperformance of some of its largest constituents. That six of the 10 largest companies on the index represent almost 50% of its market cap, and that's their outperformance has really overshadowed, you know, pretty mundane performance for much of the rest of the market. And the S&P 500 has been largely range-bound just about all year. And when we look at that in the long-term context, then the S&P had ranged from 2000 to 2013 and then staged really a very impressive breakout and has lost momentum over the last year. And we have to ask ourselves, is it possible that following such an incredibly powerful breakout, is it possible that we're going to get some form of consolidation? And well, the answer has to be yes, and that's what's been going on for nearly a year. And we were treated to volatility in October, but then we question, is there any real evidence that this isn't just the first step above a long-term base, and that are we not in a secular bull market? And there's nothing has happened to question that this isn't a secular bull market, but that we're in the first step of a consolidation above a long-term base. And the outperformance of the Nasdaq, despite the fact that breadth has been deteriorating, is also an indication that this is a bull market that has got a number of very important factors supporting it, and one of those is technological innovation. And when you look at the pace of technological innovation and the fact that that's going to continue regardless of what happens with interest rates, certainly interest rates rising in 2016 is a big change for the status quo in terms of how the traders have been conditioned by the market, and that suggests that we could have additional volatility. However, then if you think about it in terms of the pace of technological innovation, it's very unlikely to be meaningfully derailed by higher interest rates, because a lot of that research is going on in universities, it's going on in research and development and budgets for very large companies and among foundations. And even among companies, then, the research generally may move from one company to another as takeovers occur or bankruptcies occur and rationalization occurs, but that the research continues. And that's exactly what we saw after the crash in following the tech bubble, where larger, better capitalized companies were given a rare opportunity to pick up very promising technology and then continue to develop it. And the bull market that is evident right now is predicated because on that R&D that's been going on for over 15 years, and commercialization of some of those technologies that were promised in the TMT bubble is really what this is all about. And when we look at the energy sector, well, this has been an incredible year, and oil prices have declined, and declined probably more than just about anybody was anticipating. Well, we were early in identifying that shale oil and gas was going to be a game changer for the energy sector, and that's certainly the case. And I think it's pretty clear at this stage that that is fully in the price. And one of the important factors behind the unconventional oil and gas boom is that these unconventional wells tend to have a very early peak profile, in that there is prolific supply comes out at the very beginning, but that the well reaches its peak supply really very early. And that means that if you want to continue to grow the production profile of the field, you have to continue drilling. You're drilling all the time. But and 3 or 4 years ago, that would have been viewed as something that was disastrous for the sector, because these unconventional wells are expensive to drill, and you're constantly doing it, and that's a constant drain of cash flow. But in a low price environment, what it means is that they can stop drilling. The profile of the well will peak in its normal fashion, and then that will automatically inhibit additional supply gains, so that supply will deteriorate. Then they can wait for prices to pick up before they start drilling again. And it really then means that you're only drilling when you can get the price that you want, and you stop drilling when you can't. And that's very similar to the kind of environment that we had in natural gas. Natural gas had rallied spectacularly after Hurricane Katrina, and then has been coming down pretty much ever since. And from a peak around $17 to 10 years ago, it was at almost $1.50 earlier this week. Well, $1.50 is incredibly low, and there is no incentive to drill any kind of well to get out natural gas at those levels. It's important because 2016 is, and these are the kinds of things that are already in the price. So what's coming up in terms of price discovery? Well, next year, the Sabine Pass LNG export facility is going to come online, and the first cargoes will ship in January. And that means that U.S. natural gas, for the first time, is going to have an outlet for exports. It took something like 5 years to build that facility, but now it's done. And it's U.S. natural gas is going out into a global market where there is plenty of the stuff around. And it also means that the U.S. price is likely to rise over time to become fungible with the global price. Of course, the other way to think about it is that the global price could come down somewhat as U.S. Gas moves out into the global market. But what it also means is that because of the additional security of supply that is going to lend the global market, then the argument for using natural gas as a feedstock for utilities, not just in the U.S. but elsewhere, becomes more compelling. And the global market for natural gas will grow. And over time, that will help to take down the excess supply. But there's plenty of supply when natural gas prices are just about $2 at the close of this week. But there's plenty of supply around $4. And it suggests then that we're going to have to see a meaningful and resurgence in and growth in demand for natural gas before prices can be sustained above $4, which is the break even for a lot of the marginal supply. And that's that kind of long rangey environment is something that we can probably anticipate for oil. The US will begin shipping oil exports for the first time in over 30 years in January. And that has allowed the spread between Brent and WTI to contract. Well, before 2010, WTI traded at a mild premium to Brent crude, and almost never above $5 of a premium. But it's entirely questionable why WTI would trade at a premium when it can be exported. And then that suggests that the arbitrage between Brent and WTI is unlikely to last, that it's no longer going to be a profitable trade because there isn't any real reason why there should be a spread now that exports can take place. But it also means then that this also adds to additional the security of supply. It adds an additional component to the global market, and there has been an incredible amount of bad news priced into the oil, into the oil market. We've already seen that I think it's approximately 18 bankruptcies have occurred in the Texas oil patch, and we can anticipate that there will be more of that. That there's going to be rationalization in the energy sector, and it's not in the interests of OPEC to continue to keep prices depressed. So, but that also suggests that if there's a good argument that oil is going to follow the trajectory of natural gas, and that we could be in a lengthy but volatile range for the foreseeable future, and more likely than not, we're towards the lower side of that range at present. And oil rallied for the first time in just about all of this month over the last couple of days. And low energy prices represent a powerful tailwind for economic growth. And I think it's rather funny that in the financial press over the last few days, what you've seen is these stories saying, oh, the the consumer hasn't been spending the dividend that they've received from oil. And that's largely irrelevant, because what it means is that it just takes time, that the consumer in the US has been through a difficult period of time, and they're in saving mode, and it's going to take time for security and a feeling of security to come back in. But when you think about it in terms of major oil-consuming nations, then the low oil price is a remarkable turn of events, and it reduces a headwind to economic growth, because higher oil prices act as a tax on economic growth, and this is really very meaningful, and probably most important of all for countries like India and Japan, and indeed much of Europe. Europe isn't exactly the most energy replete area. Then if you look at, for example, India, that this year hasn't been the index is down from a peak in March of about 9,000 down to a low last week of about 7,500, and there's a progression of lower rally highs there, but India represents a growth opportunity and had done spectacularly well in 2014, and it'll be interesting to see how it does in January. Will it will India now be able to return to a position of favor among global investors? It's certainly beginning to find support, but there's still a progression of lower rally highs, so it has more to do to really start to get people excited about it. And if oil prices have indeed found a low, then the deep oversold conditions that a number of energy producing nations have exhibited in their stock markets could begin to be unwound. And I've posted charts today of the Indonesian rupiah, because the rupiah had trended lower for 4 years and had, I think, exceeded its Asian financial crisis nadir, but experienced a very sharp rally in October, and then rallied over the last couple of days with just a little bit steadier oil price to test the region, the moving average. And we don't have the kind of corruption scandal in Indonesia right now that we have in Brazil. And in fact, the kind of policies that Widodo has been implementing haven't received any kind of attention, but he's doing all the right things, and he's just been faced with a very difficult environment and hasn't had the kind of majority in parliament that Mr. Modi in India has enjoyed. So Indonesia has underperformed by a considerable margin, but if energy prices have indeed found a medium-term low, and we don't have any great evidence of that yet, I think in the short term what we can only conclude is that the potential for a reversionary rally has increased. And to conclude that a medium-term low is in, we'll have to see the lows hold on a pullback. And, well, we're probably not going to see that at least until the new year. But if we assume that the lows, that a great deal of bad news has been priced into the commodity complex already, and that we're now starting to see some of these energy-related emerging markets turning to positions of outperformance, is, well, that perhaps is a clue for what we can expect from 2016. That we've had massive currency devaluation, the dollar has been incredibly strong, and at the same time commodities have pulled back incredibly sharply, and this has represented really quite a challenge for emerging markets, not least because corporations have been borrowing US dollars in anticipation of paying them back in a firmer domestic currency. And that represents a significant carry trade, which was unwound and came under great pressure this year. But the dollar has already rallied a lot. And for it to continue to rally, then the US doesn't want to see the dollar go up in a straight line. And we already have incredibly oversold conditions in a number of emerging market currencies. And foreign investors aren't going to be interested in those emerging markets until they have some kind of confidence that the currency has found near to medium term lows. And in Indonesia, you definitely have evidence of that. It's still tentative in the Brazilian real. The low absolutely has to hold on the current pullback. The South African rand, with the deterioration of standards of governance that are, that you have a figurehead in Jacob Zuma, where the volatility that he introduced into the international perceptions of South African governance 2 weeks ago, with chopping and changing his finance minister in the space of 24 hours, and amid a period of time where the rand has been deteriorating in a marked fashion, well, then there's no evidence that the rand has found a low, and we're almost certainly going to see it retested and potentially exceeded until we see some evidence that governance is improving. And it really is that governance is everything, that we need to see that things are getting better. That, and it's not even a question of whether there's democracy, but do we have property rights? Do we have standards of governance improving? How are minority shareholder interests preserved? And then, is there an independent judiciary? And all of those things fit together. Because if you don't have improving standards of governance, then how can you trust the balance sheets of the companies that you're investing in? If you don't have property rights and minority shareholder interests, then how do you know that you're going to be able to get your money back once you invest it? And you need to have an independent judiciary, because then if the company that you've invested in goes bust or there's malfeasance, that you can at least take your case to the court. And when those types of things are all fitting into place, we can conclude that governance is improving. But when those sorts of things are not fitting into place, well, then we can conclude that governance is deteriorating. And it's not a question of governance being an absolute factor, but rather that the trajectory of governance, because we only need to see that it's getting better, regardless of how low the absolute level is. We just need to see that it's getting better. But we cannot conclude that right now in South Africa. But we probably can conclude that that is occurring in Indonesia. We can conclude that it's occurring in Argentina, and 2016 is probably going to be a big year for Argentina. That they've just got in their currency devaluation. And the important thing about currency devaluations, when governance is beginning to improve, is that once the devaluation has occurred, then once international investors have some kind of confidence that the lows are in, then the competitiveness that has been lent to the economy starts to be reappreciated, and then you can start to see that things start to improve. So 2016 is likely to be a very important year for a number of emerging markets, where we have evidence that governance is beginning to improve. And if we're at a point where commodities are hitting not just short-term lows, but medium-term lows, then that could potentially also be important for a number of the large commodity exporting countries. And the reason that it's important to think about this right now is because markets are thin. And in this kind of environment, where a lot of people take some time off and market liquidity goes down, and we have these really overextended moves, then it doesn't take much. It takes a few traders to band together that have got some sizable assets that they can throw around, and they have the capacity to move markets, so that when people come back to work on the day after the 1st of January, and look around and say, well, golly, this thing has had a very big rally, so that's something that we need to take some interest in, that then those are the kinds of things that might be leading into next year. And then if we look at the predicates on which our contention that this is a secular bull market are based, then, well, technological innovation is a given. And low energy prices, well, they're very low at the moment, but it's increasingly unlikely that we're going to see very high energy prices in future, and that removes a headwind to growth. And, well, we've gone through a whole year where emerging markets have gone through incredible volatility and a number have experienced currency devaluation. And that's not necessarily bad news. What it means is that their competitiveness has improved and it sets them up for better performance going forward. And then that suggests that the greatest urbanization in history is still continuing apace, and that the rising standards of living, which will drive demand for just about everything, remains a considerable factor. And certainly it had some difficulty this year, and it's likely to be a better year next year because of that, because the potential is that some of these currencies have already bottomed. And if we look at that in terms of the various stock markets, then the NASDAQ remains very steady. And generally speaking, there's two ways of looking at this, that we're starting to move into a new interest rate rising cycle. And generally speaking, at the beginning of that cycle, it's positive for equity markets and not generally very positive for the US dollar. It takes a while for interest rates to start to bite. And at the very beginning, it's viewed as a vote of confidence that the economy is firing on all cylinders and therefore can accept that there's going to be interest rate hikes. Well, when we look at the role that liquidity has had in the performance of stock markets, that's the great unknown. We don't know just yet what the role of or how much of an impact the incredibly low interest rates and how responsible they have been for the continued fuel for buybacks. Share buybacks have represented trillions of dollars invested in the stock market over the last number of years. And institutional investors have been underweight, and retail investors have been underweight, and companies themselves have been buying their shares back with alacrity. And if we look at the S&P 500, it's finishing out the year pretty much where it started the year, but in between we've had a fairly large pullback and it's still trading above the psychological 2000 level. And provided it continues to hold above that 2000 level, then I don't think there's going to be an awful lot for people to be worried about. And even if it pulls back to test to the October low, well, then it would still be in the context of a medium-term range. It's when it pulls back below the October low that the potential is that we're going to move into a much lengthier and more volatile ranging phase. And that probably is the worst-case scenario, that having experienced two major crashes in a decade, that 2016 is unlikely to represent the kind of risk that was there in 2007 or in 1999, because despite the fact that breadth has narrowed, that we don't have the valuations now that we had then, and there's still quite a bit of value out there, and not least right now in the commodity sector. And if we look at Europe, then the market there is subject to really quite a lot of volatile trading, but that's where we have a central bank that is continuing to flood the market with liquidity, and despite the fact that the euro-denominated equities are rehabilitating from pretty extreme moves early in the year as a result of the euro's devaluation, then the broad pattern is that is for appreciation. And when we look at some of these European stock market indices, and not least the Euro stocks, that it just looks to be behind the curve relative to Wall Street. That this kind of pullback that we've had for much of this year looks pretty similar to what we had in 2011, before we had the more lengthy period of quantitative easing. And it's hard to imagine that the ECB is going to be raising rates anytime soon. And the European economy just isn't there yet. And generally speaking, that should be positive for equity markets. And when we look at Japan, then the yen is now trading at 120. And the Bank of Japan kind of shocked the market last week when it didn't accelerate its quantitative easing program. And, well, one of the reasons that they mentioned for that was that economic growth was a bit better than they had anticipated, and they didn't think that it was required. And while that's great news for the economy, it's not particularly good news for the stock market. And it means that we're probably going to get some kind of rotation in Japan towards more domestically oriented stocks, whereas it has been the exporters have made all the running over the last couple of years. And if the yen strengthens through 120, then that would be an inconsistency for the dollar's three-year uptrend, and would represent probably potentially an opportunity for the domestic Japanese market, and not least the property market. But it would be a headwind for the export sector. So rotation in Japan is really quite a significant factor that we can anticipate for 2016. And China has been the subject of incredible volatility this year, and has found support at a higher level, that it's finding support above the base that it was in evidence before it took off. And, well, it's subject to incredible volatility, and there's still a significant government support is still a significant factor. And it's interesting that the bank sector, which represents such a large weighting in the overall index, have retraced more than half of their decline and are currently pressuring the upper side of what has been a three-month range. Well, China is still in this process of transitioning from an infrastructure-led economic growth model to one that's dependent more on people and services. And those are the sectors that are likely to benefit most from that transition. It's going to be people-focused sectors like healthcare and technology rather than the property market, which, you know, and then the resources market, where there is this enormous overcapacity in steel and cement, and that's unlikely to remain. That's unlikely to be there 5 or 6 years from now. There's going to be some pretty extreme rationalization, but China's going to remain a very large player in the basic resources and material sectors for the foreseeable future. And when we look at a number of the high population countries, well, China's in this transition, and there is reason to believe that standards of governance are improving gradually, despite the fact that the standards of governance that are in evidence are nowhere near in absolute terms where we would like to see them, and not least from the perspective of a European or a North American investor. Then you look at some of the other high population countries like Indonesia, which I've spoken about already, or India, which has had a more difficult time this year, and you may do a bit better next year. And then look at Nigeria and Africa, which is a continent, you know, where if you take the entire continent, there's only about 1,200 shares listed. And we have your massive population growth, and with the global population anticipated to go to about 8 billion over the next 20 years, there's going to be an awful lot of those people going to be African. And technological innovation and low energy prices are the kinds of things that could be incredibly beneficial, and not least the kind of innovation that is happening in healthcare. That a number of the sort of intransigent diseases like malaria and West Nile virus and dengue fever, those are the kinds of things that where if we see progress, that they would remove a significant headwind to growth from just about the entire sub-Saharan African region. And considering that that is where the major population growth centers are, that it's going to represent a phenomenally good news. And that's not in the price at all. That what most people are worried about right now is the impact that the fall in commodity prices have had for those countries. And obviously that is very significant. And there is a risk that we're going to see additional currency market devaluation. Those are potentially short-term factors. And the medium to long-term potential is that these countries become manufacturing centers. We're already seeing that in parts of East Africa. And that's likely to be a growing trend for the foreseeable future. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish Merry Christmas and all seasonal greetings to all of you.